Odysseus, a man who has seen much sorrow. The Stranger on the Shore. A salt-caked, sunburned, wind-scoured man lies face down and naked on a beach. Sandflies skip on the scarred skin of his back. From a distance, you would take him to be dead, but come nearer, and you will see the bellows of his chest opening and closing. Behind the thunder of the surf and the scream of gulls can be heard the sound of human laughter, a squealing, gasping laughter of young people at play. A leather ball rolls at speed across the sand until it is stopped in its course by the sleeping man's head. The muscles on the man's back twitch and bunch as he wakes. He raises his head and shoulders. His eyebrows compress into a frown as he tries to make sense of the damp, sand-crusted ball in front of his eyes. He has never seen such an object in all his life. How long a life? It might be 40 years, it might be 60. The muscle tone belongs to a younger man, but the white-streaked hair and harsh lines of suffering on the face tell of one who has endured 5 lifetimes. The distant laughter from behind the rocks now catches and holds its breath. The man engages the sinews of his legs to stand upright. For all the effort and pain that every movement brings him, we can see at once that he is strong, balanced, and athletic. His sudden, broad, masculine nakedness causes a gasp of shock along the bay, then shrill peals of delight, then muffled giggles, then panicked splashing, until finally there is only the loud silence of seabirds and breaking waves. Whoever they were, the piercing pitch of their hysteria suggests children or young girls, they have run away. All but one. The man shades his eyes and sees wet clothes draped over the rocks. From behind the largest of these rocks, a form emerges, features flattened into silhouette by the late afternoon sun behind. The form comes closer, hesitant but determined. As the man stares, the outline resolves into the figure of a girl. The man reaches quickly down to tear off a branch of thick leaves to cover his nakedness. The girl is no older than 16. While she shows no fear, she cannot keep from her eyes a look of astonishment. Perhaps something more than astonishment. When the distance between them is no more than the man's height, she brings herself to a stop. He tries to speak, but his throat is dry and the words stick. The girl speaks. "Who are you?"
"Don't be afraid."
"I am not afraid." The girl is pleased to hear, through the stranger's parched croak, the proper tones of Attic Greek. "Who are you?" The man spreads his free arm, the one that is not pressing the leaves to his manhood.
"A traveller, lost and far from home."
"What is this place?"
She stares. Can he be joking?
A weak cough escapes the man's throat. He quickly barks out another, but stronger, as if to make the first seem deliberate.
Are we on an island, or is this the mainland?
The sea cast me up here. She looks around as if the answer were obvious and written in every dune and wind-blown pine. This is scarier. He looks up at the sky with a frown. The mists of his memory begin to clear. Of course, the home island of the Phaeacian people. Just so. My father, Alcinous, is the king. The man bows.
Princess,
there's no need to mock me.
I show supplication. All that I am is all that you see. I'm lost. Everything I have is lost. My men, my ships, my everything. I've been imprisoned on an island for 7 years. I am as I stand before you, naked and alone.
Oh, you poor man.
The stranger's savagery of demeanour ought to be alarming, but the girl reads a fierce blend of inexpressible suffering and inextinguishable hope in his eyes. It touches her. He gives another cough.
You must be starving.
If I may presume upon your kindness, and she finds herself dropping her knees in a kind of curtsy. On Skeria, we honour Zeus and the laws of hospitality above all things. Now she throws her head back over her shoulders and calls out for her attendant maidens. They have been peeping over the dunes, watching. Come now shyly forward, giggling and bowing.
Girls, look, here is a stranger. Find him food and some clothes. Let him wash himself.
The bravest of the girls beckons, and the man follows. He is given bread and wine and a flask of olive oil. Adding a little sand to the oil, he scrubs himself down, rinsing off with seawater. The girls run away, their laughter louder yet. Only the first girl, the princess, stays behind. She says, in answer to the question in his eyes, "Our city is over the hill. If you go through the gate, can you not guide me there? If I were seen in your company, people might think my father..." She breaks off, angry with herself for blushing and stumbling over her words. The stranger seems to understand. "Of course. Through the gate, then. Past the Temple of Poseidon and the marketplace, then through the palace gates at the end. They're always open. My father will be in the hall, hearing petitions and settling disputes. Ignore him. Seek out my mother instead, Queen Arete. At this time of day she will be by the fire, spinning."
"I shall do just as you say."
"Sir, aren't you forgetting something?"
He looks about him like a puzzled child.
"You can hardly expect to be received in that condition. Come over to the rocks with me."
She extends a hand. His vulnerability has brought out a calm, maternal spirit that she did not know she possessed.
"We were washing our clothes. Let me see what might fit you. Try this chiton. I'm afraid it is still damp."
"Not as damp as the sea." She turns her back to allow him to dress himself. "You are kindness itself." He steps into the chiton, which is too small for him.
Tell me, though, the leather sphere that awoke me. What is that?"
"Oh, this." She goes over to the ball and throws it to him.
"We play games with it."
He catches it, hefts it in his hands, pleased with the weight and feel.
"What sort of games?"
"Tossing, kicking, catching games." This is thought to be the first reference to ball games in all recorded history.
"Now, go where I told you. I need to collect up the rest of these clothes before the sun sets."
"May I know your name, princess?"
"Nausicaa."
"I shall see you at the house of your parents, then, Nausicaa." The stranger obeys Nausicaa's instructions. He passes the Temple of Poseidon, ignoring the stares of wonder he attracts as he shoulders his way through the crowded agora. No Phaeacian will ever forget the sight of this wild man striding towards the palace with the bearing of a warrior, yet wearing without embarrassment the gold-trimmed chiton of a gently born female. He finds the queen of the Phaeacians just as the princess had told him, spinning at the hearthside. Conforming with the custom of those in supplication,
the stranger kneels down and grasps her knees.
"Why, you poor man," says Queen Arete, unconsciously echoing her daughter's words. "I don't believe I have ever seen someone so exhausted. You are in time to join us at table. Here is my husband. Why don't you sit between us?"
The traveller is touched to be treated with such kindness and respect. King Alcinous and Queen Arete are too well-bred to ask him questions, but they can tell that this is a man who has seen much sorrow, much pain, much suffering, much life. There is one question the king cannot forbear from putting to his guest. With puzzlement, he says,
"I'm sure I've seen that gown before."
"Silly man," says his wife, "it's Nausicaa's."
"How the deuce did he come by it, then?"
"I gave it to him, father," says Nausicaa, joining them. "You have always taught me that no virtue is higher than guest friendship."
"Oh, yes, quite right. Good girl. Here's to Xenia."
Alcinous raises a cup of wine and beams around the table. Queen Arete looks at Nausicaa's flushed face and averted gaze and smiles. She remembers the old saying, "It is easier to conceal an elephant under your arm than to hide the look of love in your eye." Alcinous bangs down his cup.
"Now that you've eaten, we must have some entertainment. You will love the songs and stories of our visiting bard. What have you got for us, Demodocus?"
The stranger has not feasted better for weeks, perhaps months. He cannot remember. And now there is to be music and song. He hopes that the bard's poetry will not be so dull as to send him to sleep. That would be discourteous. The old poet, addressed as Demodocus, comes forward eagerly at the king's command. He takes up his lyre and looks heavenward as he tunes the strings. From the moment Demodocus opens his mouth, the stranger is jerked far from any idea of sleep.
"I sing of warriors, I sing of heroes," booms the bard. "I sing of those who massed in fleets against the city of Ilus. Oh, muse, let me tell of Agamemnon, king of men. Let me tell of great Ajax, mightier than an oak, who perished by his own hand. Of golden Achilles, swifter than the wind. Let me sing of the twisted ways of Ithacan Odysseus, contriver of plots."
Well into his stride, Demodocus begins to recount a story he knows well.
"Stop! Stop!"
Demodocus halts mid-speech, open-mouthed. No one but the king has ever interrupted him before. And that had only been because the hall needed to be evacuated when one of the tapestries on the wall caught fire. The whole court looks towards the wild-eyed stranger who has dared to bang the table and cry out with such fierce authority. Nausicaa sees that tears are wetting the stranger's cheeks. She nudges her father.
"My dear fellow," says Alcinous, "what can the matter be? Demodocus is sometimes a little out of tune, but..."
Nausicaa takes the stranger's hand. "Nobody meant to upset you."
It is nothing," says the traveller, allowing the tears to fall unchecked. "Only he tells it wrong. He tells it quite wrong. I know. I was there. I was there from the first, from the very beginning."
"My dear fellow," the king is astonished. The stranger wipes his eyes.
"You have shown me great hospitality, and I mean no slur on your rhapsode. Demodocus, are you called?"
The bard nods warily.
"I am the one you sing of. the one you call Twisted. I am that same Odysseus of Ithaca, contriver of plots. Demodocus tries to fall to his knees and stammer out an apology, but the stranger stays him with a hand on the shoulder. No, no, I beg you. That was as good a description of me as I ever heard. Sly, slippery, cunning, deceitful, those are the usual words.
We heard you were lost, sir, says Queen Arete. Years ago the news spread that you and all the Ithacans had perished.
The gods spared me, for reasons known only to them, says the stranger called Odysseus. It is as if everyone in the court has frozen into statues, so close and still is their attention. You will know how we laid siege to Troy for 10 years. You will know that I contrived a plot, as friend Demodocus would say.
The horse of wood and gold and ivory in which you and 1,000 men hid themselves, whispers Nausicaa, wide-eyed.
Not quite 1,000, princess, says Odysseus. 30 were all that would fit and all that were needed. The Trojans carried us into the heart of their city. After night fell, we emerged, opened the gates and let in our army.
From all we have heard, says King Alcinous gravely, no mercy was shown that night.
Odysseus bows his head. Queen Arete is severe.
Andromache's infant boy tossed over the city walls. Those of the royal house of Priam who were not slaughtered, raped and taken into slavery. There was no glory in your victory.
Odysseus looks down into his lap and is silent for a while.
I do not mean to chide you, sir.
You cannot chide me more than I chide myself. We were savage indeed. All that fighting had made us so. For 10 long years, our sleep was possessed by dreams of severed limbs, of bursting brains, of tumbling guts. Your pardon, princess. So much violence and death turned us, without knowing it, into creatures wilder, crueler, and more crazed with the lust to kill than the dragons and monsters that Heracles and the heroes slew to make the world safe. But the night we burned Troy down... You are right, madam. That night we overstepped all bounds. The gods saw to it that we paid, however. We all paid. Odysseus allows his cup to be refilled. He raises it towards Demodocus. If I tell you how it really was, you will be able to sing the truth to the next guests fortunate enough to gather under this roof and enjoy your famous Phaeacian hospitality. But don't sing of heroes. There are no heroes in this tale, only men and women, and gods, always gods. All the guests in the hall look towards Odysseus as he prepares to speak. King Alcinous and Queen Arete are as spellbound as the stewards, maidservants, and pages who stand lining the walls, mouths open in amazement. Usually, when a rhapsode rhapsodizes, the servants are all too happy to sit in their kitchens, emptying what is left in the flagons of wine the guests have returned and singing their own song. But this chance to hear firsthand the adventures of one of the world's most famous warrior kings is not to be missed. Odysseus looks around with a smile and begins his story.